Hey now, we are getting over, and I am the Silver King, Adam Silverstein, here to lead you through these hard times. With episode 565 of your favorite professional wrestling podcast. That's right, Getting Over is back once again, and it is Thursday, so you know exactly what that means. We are here to break down everything that happened over the last week in the worlds of AEW and NXT. Of course, AEW coming off the Revolution pay-per-view, NXT offering a special Roadblock television special as it continues to build for NXT Stand and Deliver on WrestleMania 40 weekend. As usual, we have an absolute ton to discuss on this edition of Getting Over. So do the Silver King a solid and allow me to remind you that the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast
is all about defiance.
So please head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a 5-star rating on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a 5-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. It is also where you can send us DMs and tweets that we will read right here on the show, whether they're questions or comments. We will try to get as many of them in as possible. Please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well, because for just $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Sign up. You will get bonus audio, the fastest 5 minutes in professional wrestling, instant reaction shows to Raw, NXT, Dynamite, and SmackDown every week, along with exclusive news posts every single Friday. And yes, we do have a new one coming up this Friday. Again, all of that on buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Now, normally on these shows, we kick off with NXT. We move over to AEW. But this week is kind of interesting because you have AEW coming off a pay-per-view, Revolution, and NXT with the special television show in NXT Roadblock. So we're actually going to switch it up a little bit. We're going to start with AEW. We're going to have NXT kind of pulling up the rear on the show. If you want to bounce around, there will be timestamps in the episode descriptions. But as always, I hope you all listen to the entire show. Now, coming off of Revolution, I did watch a couple matches over, and we always do a second look after pay-per-views and premium live events. I didn't have any additional notes to share. And this is what usually happens with AEW, because so much of their matches are just based on work rate for the most part. Unless I'm going to change my grade on a match, there's not much reason to revisit it. And that's certainly not something I am doing today. So because of that, we are going to kind of just move on from Revolution and discuss what happened on Dynamite, some remnants from Rampage and Collision. And we're actually going to kick off this AEW segment with some news items. First, something we did not mention during the Revolution instant analysis. And by the way, if you have not heard that yet, make sure you go back into our podcast feed and listen to the AEW Revolution instant analysis show that we published shortly after that pay-per-view went off the air. But something we did not mention coming out of that is AEW's next pay-per-view has already been announced. It's AEW Dynasty on Sunday, April 21st. It's going to be in St. Louis. So that's going to be pretty much a 7-week gap from Revolution, which is really solid. You know, we've mentioned this on the podcast before. We're not against AEW doing more pay-per-views as long as they're spaced out. There was a huge problem in the fall with, I think they did, you know, 3 in a 6-week period, and then there was a 4th for World's End before the year was out. It was absolutely crazy. It hurts television because you're so quickly building to the next show, and the builds aren't that great. And as everyone saw with Revolution, when Tony Khan has time to actually go build toward a pay-per-view, they can do a damn good job. And they spent a lot of time, probably more than you could argue any AEW pay-per-view perhaps in history. They spent more time and effort and had matches announced earlier than almost ever before, way in advance for Revolution, and the show was that much better because of it. So the fact that it's 7 weeks, it's a pretty solid amount of time, and certainly AEW is rolling with some momentum coming out of Revolution. Another item I wanted to mention was comments made by Darby Allin ahead of AEW Revolution, when he was asked about Sting's retirement and the way it's being handled by AEW and all that. Here's the quote from him. He said, there's a lot of places that will straight up be like, all right, you're retiring, but we're going to make sure that you wrestle this guy. And it could be a guy you have no interest in wrestling. Then the fact that you have to tuck your tail between your legs and be a nice little good boy and get a paycheck and wrestle somebody that you don't have any desire to wrestle. We're talking about your career life's work. It's baffling to me that people are such little bitches. Now, clearly what he's talking about there is Kurt Angle. And let me just say, I don't care if you're a fan of Darby Allin, if you're not a fan of Darby Allin, if you think his risks that he takes are ridiculous, if you don't think so, whatever the case, Darby Allin pretty much calling Kurt Angle a little bitch for doing what his employer wanted him to do in a situation like that is absolutely asinine. I think everyone will agree, including Kurt Angle himself, that Angle fighting Baron Corbin was stupid as his retirement match. It was not appropriate. Corbin was not the right partner. The match did not go as well as it should have, and Angle's retirement in totality should have been handled better. But this 31-year-old guy who has pretty much gotten to do whatever the hell he wants because Tony Khan books to whatever the hell his wrestlers want to do, has no business talking about a multi-decade veteran in Kurt Angle who not only grinded his way to becoming one of the top wrestlers in the world, and I don't just mean in WWE, I mean top performers in the entire industry, in his prime especially, but a guy who was a real athlete coming into the entire thing and earned every opportunity in his career, helped sell out shows, was one of the biggest names in WWE. You know, I don't mind younger guys like feeling confident in themselves and wanting to stick up for their company and their partner, I guess in this case, Sting as well. But just because you're proud of what AEW is doing with Sting doesn't mean you need to go and shit on Kurt Angle and call him a little bitch. So pretty much all I'm saying is grow up, dude. That's about it. Jim Ross signed a one-year deal to remain with AEW in his current role. It does seem like he's pretty much been taken off of television with the exception of individual matches where he will come back and call. An example, of course, being the Sting match at AEW Revolution, which he called alongside Excalibur and Tony Schiavone. And JR did a really nice job in that match, probably the best commentary job he's done in quite some time, if we're being completely candid. But he's going to be there at least for one more year in that role. Whether he remains with AEW after that, maybe changes his role after that, still remains to be seen, but good for JR sticking around there. I did have one, let's call it booking note, coming out of AEW Revolution into AEW Dynamite on Wednesday that I thought was worth mentioning. After Revolution was over, in that media scrum that Tony Khan holds, he announced that they will be stripping Sting and Darby Allin of the AEW tag team titles and will be therefore holding a tournament to determine new champions. And they went into that a little bit greater detail Wednesday on Dynamite. But I thought this was a huge missed opportunity to get some more heat on the EVPs, because what they could have done is they could have done it in the scrum, or they could have done it Wednesday on Dynamite. You have the Young Bucks come out and, as one of their announcements, say, well, they cheated to beat us and they had the numbers advantage and so on and so forth. Therefore, we're stripping Darby Allin of the AEW tag team title. He will not get the opportunity to find another partner. They will be put up for grabs in a tournament and we will be entering that tournament. It was such a huge missed opportunity to have Tony just say it in a press conference that no one's really watching live, a very small subsection of fans, as opposed to getting a ton of heat on the EVPs for making that part of the storyline on Dynamite the following Wednesday, or have them do it at the scrum and post that clip online, or do it backstage, or, you know, them informing Darby, hey, congratulations on cheating to beat us, and then taking his title away from him. There are so many different ways they could have done it. Again, just, I'll say the phrase a third time, a missed opportunity. Regarding the new AEW Dynamite logo and graphics, there's a new AEW logo as well. Let's kind of discuss all this. What they decided to do was go basically to embossed graphics, which is very like 2005. And I agree with a lot of folks where now in 2024, and really it's been the last 4 years or so, these graphics and logos across not just wrestling companies, but in media, branding, all that, they've become flat and sometimes single or just two colors. And they're very bland and annoying, but the embossed look, it is kind of old at the same time. So AEW did that to their regular logo, and they also completely changed their Dynamite logo and graphics. When it comes to Dynamite, they went back to the multicolored scheme. That's a huge positive. But I kind of wish they reverted all the way back to the original paint splashes. Instead, the way this color scheme has been put together, it does legitimately look like what NXT 2.0 did just a couple years ago. The rainbow aesthetic around the letters on the Dynamite logo is cool, and I'm into the general concept of that, but I do have two problems. The first is, like I said, the embossed look is so 2005. But second, I hate how the E in Dynamite is as large as the D. It makes it look like Dynamite, and it's just super annoying from an aesthetic standpoint. Now, as far as the set for Dynamite goes, I thought it looked great. It is tough to look at those tunnels and, you know, pardon me, not think of rolled up condoms. And regarding the new Dynamite theme song, it's really good. I'm always going to have a soft spot for the last one. And I guess if I had to grade them against one another, I would call it a downgrade. But if the other one, the older one, did not exist and they just debuted with this, I would say that's a very good theme song and, you know, extremely perfect for a wrestling show. Kind of reminds of SmackDown, Bring the Pain, a little bit. And it's very interesting the way that AEW has crafted its show opening themes, because the old one sounded like Raw and this one sounded like a SmackDown theme. But that's a positive because those themes were bangers and the shit that WWE uses now is terrible. So AEW definitely has the leg up when it comes to songs around show openings. No question about that. Another big news item, Sammy Guevara is reportedly serving a suspension from AEW stemming from that Jeff Hardy match. Seemingly, the suspension is over him, I guess, disobeying concussion protocol and hitting his finisher after kneeing Jeff in the face first on that 450. What I fail to understand is how Guevara was even in the position to do another move, given they had stopped the match and checked Jeff. At that point, the trainer and referee should be in charge, and the referee is pretty much always in charge anyway. So unless Sammy literally disobeyed the ref, and you'd think Jeff would have had to agree to that because he was the one taking the move, which would mean that either he should be suspended also, or the referee should be suspended for not stopping it. But I'm not sure why this is totally on Sammy. And I'm not saying Sammy did anything right. Please don't get it twisted. I'm just saying, how is he the only party at fault here? That is pretty tough to understand. But all we have right now is a report from Fightful to go off, so we don't have all the information. Regardless, that match never should have continued. We said it then. People shot back. Oh, clearly it wasn't a concussion. He just broke his nose. Well, he's not suspended for breaking a guy's nose because that shit can just happen. So something else happened there. Either concussion protocol wasn't followed by Sammy. It wasn't followed in totality. It was a combination of the two. You know, we don't have all those answers, but apparently he is currently suspended from the company. And again, that match continuing at all is on AEW and its protocols. That never should have been the case. Now, let's go ahead and get into the breakdowns of Dynamite, Rampage, and Collision. In terms of TV matches with storyline relevance this week, look, Collision and Rampage were almost completely without context. It was an all-time low since we've been doing this metric. 27% of matches mattered in storyline, and the ones that did were almost entirely on Dynamite. With the roster that AEW possesses, there is literally no reason they cannot build TV-specific storylines that end on Collision, just like WWE does frequently with SmackDown, going into a pay-per-view. A lot of times, WWE will have a United States Championship match or an Intercontinental title match or just a regular feud that is concluded on that go-home show. That way, that show is still important, not despite the fact that there's a premium live event 24 hours later. Dynamite was an extremely strong show Wednesday night, but Rampage and Collision were absolutely awful. The truth is, life would be so much better if the AEW roster was just a bit smaller and the other shows did not exist. Even if Dynamite was 3 hours or something like that. I would just prefer not to have to deal with Rampage at all and Collision the vast majority of the time. So with that said, let's get into breaking down these shows. On Dynamite, Swerve Strickland opened. He was way over with the fans as usual. He wondered if his failures were karma and got the fans chanting, "You deserve it," by thinking he might be nothing more than a mid-carder. Swerve said Sunday felt like fans were rooting for him for the first time and he wouldn't let them down. He promised Samoa Joe that he'd beat him for the title. Joe entered basically disagreeing with all those assertions. Swerve pointed out he'd never beaten him and challenged Joe immediately. Out came Undisputed Kingdom, with Adam Cole putting over Roderick Strong's international title win, and Wardlow, who he said would soon challenge Joe for the AEW title. He also said Joe was only champion because of them, which is true. Swerve shot back about having Britt Baker's like burner number, so Cole issued a Kingdom versus Swerve and Joe challenge with Tony Khan through Tony Schiavone saying it's happening immediately. Now, why Swerve would be fine just immediately putting aside his challenge to team with Joe against two nobodies, I can't tell you that, but it's not that abnormal for a show opener like this. We saw this back in the day in WWE all the time. So we had Joe and Swerve against the Kingdom. Joe took most of the punishment, but once Swerve tagged in, the match basically went straight to the finish. The idea being Joe could not handle Kingdom 2-on-1, but Swerve was able to. He hit Swerve Stomp, House Call, JML Driver for the win. Shorter than normal AEW match, but appropriate because Kingdom is nobody compared to the two main eventers. At the same time, shouldn't they now be number one contenders for the ROH tag team titles? Because they just beat the champions, right? Wardlow distracted, walking down the ramp after the bell, so Joe quickly put Swerve in a headlock, knocking him out and then holding up the title. Then it was announced 5 seconds later that Joe Wardlow was happening at Big Business next week. This after Cole, I'll remind you, said Wardlow would challenge eventually, just a few minutes earlier. It was a solid opening segment overall, largely due to the fans' reaction to Swerve, but it left something to be desired from the standpoint of turning a page and moving in a new direction, which I hoped would be the case given how long we've had the same people in the main event picture. If they're just going right back and they're going to do Swerve and Joe in St. Louis, that's where Swerve is going to win the AEW title. I cannot imagine Wardlow winning the championship over Joe on TV unless the idea is just to do a surprise change because they want more viewers for Big Business, or they think there will be more viewers for Big Business, and therefore they want to do something to pop them. And then Wardlow could serve as a transitional champion for Swerve as a means of protecting Joe. But for me, Swerve needs to go over someone like a Joe, like a Hangman, a big time champion, and Wardlow getting the title and dropping it 6 weeks later would not be the same deal. It'll be more than fair to judge this after we see what happens next week. So right now we're just going to put a pin in the entire thing. On Dynamite, Kyle O'Reilly backstage said he thought he might not wrestle again, but he's officially cleared and sees this as a second chance. He said he turned away Roddy and Undisputed Kingdom because he just has to do it on his own. It's not really an explanation that makes much sense. They're real life friends of his, but maybe this is going to develop into a feud with Strong for the title and become more logical sooner than later. On Dynamite, commentary said rumors had been circulating about Hangman Page all day. The Young Bucks in suits backstage said they had two huge announcements to make later in the ring. It was a fun play on Tony Khan hyping up every announcement. They tried to do his cadence, like while staring into the camera, but they did miss bugging out their eyes and clearly reading off paper. It actually had me hoping that when they came to the ring to do announcements that they would be duds, but that wasn't really the case. AEW later ran a video package about the vacant tag team championships, but it was really strange because production used Khan's monotone press conference explanation rather than having him or literally anyone else, Excalibur, Schiavone, the Bucks, as I said, tape something that was more exciting to overlay like this video package onto. It was an extremely strange decision because it came across like lackluster. We're going to have another tag team championship tournament and it's going to be great. We have a tag team division, as opposed to something like sounding monumental where we're going to crown new champions. It's going to be this big deal. So it was just a strange production decision for them to do that. The EVPs opened hour two screaming at Schiavone for mentioning they got their asses kicked by Sting. They claimed that Sting and Darby cheated given the numbers advantage and promised to win the tag team titles back in the tournament. The Bucks first announced that Hangman was suspended indefinitely from the Elite, not AEW, the Elite, without pay, all due to him hitting referees. Then they fired Kenny Omega from the Elite for not being around, and they were wondering why he wasn't there, obviously ignoring his real-life health concerns. So Eddie Kingston interrupted before the second announcement. He threw money at the Bucks because he knew he was about to get fined. The Bucks then low-blowed and attacked him, but as they were about to hit the EVP trigger, we got the coin drop and Kazuchika Okada appearing in a suit. He slowly stormed down to a pretty solid pop, looking like he was going to side with Eddie, only to grab him by the waist of his jeans and hit a really clunky Rainmaker in a heel turn. The Bucks celebrated and announced that Okada was officially in the Elite. Okada then indicated he was going after the Continental Crown title. So I want you to stay with me for this, okay? Because I would say about 80% of this segment sucked, but the last 20% was great. Okada coming out in the suit should have been a dead giveaway, but it was still a surprising turn just because Okada as a heel is not something that anyone who has followed New Japan is really used to seeing. It freshens him up as he joins a new company. It allows him to at least temporarily get over the language barrier because now he has people who can speak for him. And it provides immediate feuds with Hangman, less likely, more likely Omega when they eventually return. I have a feeling Hangman's going to come back, and you're realizing that they only suspended him from the Elite, not AEW, which means he's technically still in the Elite. The Bucks are heels. Hangman could come back as a heel, so I could see them all being together. I thought it was an extremely smart booking decision to turn Okada heel and align him with the Bucks, which obviously just makes sense because they do have a legitimate long-term friendship dating back to New Japan. It became obvious that Okada was going to AEW a few weeks ago. As we discussed previously on the podcast, it was the easy move for him, just given his comfort with the company and much of the locker room. It would have been far more intriguing to see what would have happened with Okada in WWE, just because there are so many opponents there that he has never faced. But the ability to not live full-time in the United States and probably get paid a similar amount, I think much more money, made it a no-brainer for him. Tokyo Sports reported just before we started recording this podcast that Okada is getting $13.5 million over 3 years, so basically $4.5 million a year. It's been reported, I think, that Roman Reigns is making $5 million a year in WWE. And look, Okada is great. An argument can be made that he's the greatest professional wrestler alive right now, at least in terms of in-ring. I mean, I think Will Ospreay is better than him just, again, in 2024. Okada is incredible. But if he's actually getting that money, then there is zero surprise why WWE either did not offer him that, more than it, or anything close to it. Especially, let's repeat, he's not going to live full-time in the United States. And let's just be candid about the situation, okay? When CM Punk signed with AEW, I believe he was getting paid $3 million a year. CM Punk sold out the United Center. He helped sell out All In at Wembley Stadium and many other pay-per-views in big-time arenas. Everyone pretty much knew Okada was debuting for AEW on this show. They put 3,000 people in a less than half-full arena in Atlanta. So if you're going to pay that guy $13.5 million and you're AEW and he's not moving the needle more significantly than that already upon his debut, I don't see how you're going to get your money out of him for that. I don't, you know, t-shirt sales and, you know, people being excited over Omega Okada 5. I don't know that you're making that money from him. So, you know, you want to pay Will Ospreay $13.5 million? I get it. You know, he's younger. He speaks English. And it's not about the fact that Okada doesn't speak English, but there is, you know, the promotion of the company, being able to go out there and be the face of the company, do interviews, all those types of things. The marketing aspect of it, it matters. And you're going to get that more from Ospreay than you are Okada, just by direct comparison. But that is a shocking number. We don't know that it's accurate. It's just what Tokyo Sports is reporting. But if it's anywhere close to that, I cannot imagine that WWE came in that ballpark for Okada. Good for him. Get the bag. And if that's what AEW is going to pay, then, hey, maybe they do take some top-tier talent from WWE over the next 12 to 18 months. If they're just going to overpay for people, then anything is possible. We saw it happen with WCW back in the day. It could certainly happen with AEW here. Now, AEW has done a decently solid job booking Konosuke Takeshita, and Okada is a far bigger name with a much greater and deeper history. It's going to be really interesting to see if they can book him similarly, but at a main event level. Starting him as a heel at least makes the signing compelling at the beginning, and this did seem to set up Omega Okada 5, maybe for Wembley Stadium, and possibly for the Continental Crown Championship, because surely Kazu is going to take that off Eddie whenever he has that match, one would presume, at Dynasty. So that's the Okada bit. Let's go ahead and move on with the rest of AEW this week. On Dynamite, Darby Allin entered carrying his title and a bat. He's fighting Jay White next week for no reason whatsoever. Seemingly the idea is that he's going to lose and then get written off for injury because he's going to climb Mount Everest. And that's real. In fact, he mentioned it during the promo, saying there's no guarantee he's going to come back alive. So he wanted to thank every fan and AEW for helping him live his dream. He was choked up saying that, and also clarified that he couldn't replace Sting as a partner, which is why he was relinquishing the title. White then came out basically doing my job, reiterating everything that happened at Revolution. He said he didn't care, except he literally knew everything that happened. And then he said he bet Darby would be a lost puppy without Sting in AEW. The idea was White giving Darby an out for their match, saying they could hang out together instead. Allen tried to break the fourth wall, saying they're fighting because White has done nothing since joining AEW, and he doesn't believe in his hype. Then he whispered something in his ear that we don't know, stuck his bat in his throat. Look, I'm a big fan of Jay. This was an awful promo. Maybe what Darby said is going to get revealed. It'll make sense. It'll make this meaningful. We'll see. But this segment dragged immensely. It was like twice as long as it needed to be. It barely had any heat, and it was just rough. On Dynamite, Kyle Fletcher fought Will Ospreay in a non-title match. This was the main event. There was no real additional build on the show itself. Ospreay had a nice flip-out Hurricanrana attempt into a spike DDT. Fletcher ducked a hidden blade, but Ospreay did an Oz cutter on the ring apron, jumping off the turnbuckle. He landed right on his hip. That looked nasty. Then he had a poison Rana and flipped out of an avalanche dragon suplex attempt for a Liger Bomb. Ospreay took a nasty move on his shoulder and a last ride powerbomb. He came back with an avalanche poison Rana, which is crazy. And really, the match should have ended right there. That's a sick move. Just count the 1, 2, 3. But then he hit a hidden blade, and that was a false finish. There were multiple counters into a Spanish fly for another false finish, an Oz cutter for a third false finish. And finally, Fletcher sat up asking for a hidden blade to the face. Ospreay gave it to him and got the 1, 2, 3. Bryan Danielson entered with a huge grin after the bell. They did a quick stare down as Dynamite ended. This was an exceptional TV match by any measure. And if there was a separate category, probably a front runner for TV match of the year. It was immensely one-sided though. Fletcher's offense was super limited. Ospreay was hitting move after move and Fletcher was just kicking out to stay alive. This guy's the ROH champion, so I understand they wanted to keep him strong, but it should also mean, just like I said before, that Will should be getting a title shot, right? Second time on the show that an ROH champion lost a non-title match and nothing's going to come of it. Not that I wanted to be ROH champion. I'm just saying. I'm at 4.5 stars and an A for the match because it truly was a spectacle and it was pretty damn clean, all things considered. A definite
banger.
The Danielson interaction was interesting, so let's hope we actually get Ospreay's first storyline starting next week. That would make for a solid segment on Big Business, with a match likely coming at the Dynasty pay-per-view. But what I'm curious about is why you have Ospreay getting these huge babyface chants, two matches against people in the Don Callis family, and they didn't turn him babyface. He's still in the family. He's still technically a heel. Maybe something will come of that with Danielson getting him out of there, extricating him from it. I don't know, but as of right now, that remains strange. On Dynamite, the FTW title was on the line, Hook defending against Brian Cage. Chris Jericho interrupted a Hook interview backstage before he spoke, of course, tying a line between Taz and ECW, with him now respecting Hook after being suplexed by him. He offered a fist bump and some rub. Cage caught Hook jumping off the steps for a ringside power slam before running himself through a barricade. Hook hit two T-bone suplexes, one into a guardrail. They botched a Cassidora neckbreaker, but Cage hit a powerbomb and F5 into a chair. Cage then dumped out thumbtacks. Hook hit a third T-bone ass first into them. Then he locked in Red Rum. Cage fell backwards onto the tacks, but Hook maintained the hold despite having tacks in his back for the knockout victory. Gates of Agony immediately attacked. Jericho saved. So we have another guy for Jericho to kind of glom onto in a tag team situation. Hopefully Hook will get some further rub from him before it's over. The match was fun. Good action in spots. I love the finish with Hook being unaffected by the tacks. Made him look really tough. I'd say that took this to like a full 3.5 stars and a B. On Collision, Mariah May beat a jobber in 3 minutes. She got excited when Toni Storm came out, but Toni ducked her, who was trying to hug her, and she just called out Deonna Purrazzo, and we, of course, discussed what happened there on Sunday night. On Dynamite, Toni backstage said she'll be presenting her first ever Toni with an I award. She also presented Mariah, who was dressed still as Toni's old gimmick, with her first ever AEW t-shirt, which was also May dressed as Storm. This may have actually been my favorite thing that Toni's ever done, which probably goes to show that I dislike the rest of it. On Collision, Serena Deeb got a backstage promo putting herself over as undeniable, saying no one has challenged her. She did the wrist lock and wrist watch line and then spoke into the camera, daring anyone who thinks they are the best in the world to come challenge her. She also said she's the final boss. This was probably a call out to Mercedes Moné for a debut match. If you think about it though, Mercedes would then beat the final boss in her first match, right? Deeb remains awful on the mic, but the concept here was fine. On Dynamite, Chris Statlander fought Rio. No rhyme or reason for this match, of course. Rio hit a dragon suplex on Stat, which looked impossible. Stat powerbombed Rio for a four count that the referee simply did not call. Stokely Hathaway threw a chain in the ring. Stack grabbed it and dumped it ringside. Then she hit a wheelbarrow German suplex and a deadlift German, but Rio rolled her over for the 1-2-3. Later backstage, Stoke called Stat his favorite, but wished she accepted his help. Willow Nightingale, of course, was bothered by that, but excited that she was going to fight Rio next week. Willow said she knows that she can beat Rio and said her sights were now set on the TBS championship. Julia Hart later said she'd have an open challenge this weekend. So the goal of this match was primarily, at least from my perspective, to finally put some good women's wrestling on TV before Mercedes Moné debuts next week. They got decent time, and while Rio beating Stat was kind of silly, given the skill, size differential, and probability for it to do nothing for Rio, like, is she actually going to get a title match out of this? What's the point? It advanced the story for Stokes' group. 3.5 stars B for the match. Given the open challenge and Willow's stated intent, shouldn't she be jumping at the opportunity this week before fighting Rio next week? That's an unnecessary plot hole if she does not. On Dynamite, Orange Cassidy backstage said he was focused on filling his backpack with another championship. Chuck Taylor then suggested Orange and Trent Beretta enter the tag team tournament, saying they had a match set for Rampage to get acclimated together. Makes sense for them to team. Curious to see the entire bracket and which teams are competing, but as I said on that instant analysis for AEW Revolution, I really wish Orange was just off TV, taking 2, 3, 4 months of time for himself. Let him refresh, come back. He's been completely overexposed in AEW. So hopefully they lose this tag team tournament in the first round. He gets kayfabe hurt and then comes back again, not with a new character, just refreshed. On Collision, Buddy Matthews had a scheduled match, but Mark Briscoe attacked him before the bell, which negated it. Briscoe hit a step up tope off a chair into Buddy through a table at ringside. House of Black attacked, but Mark fended them off 1-on-3 with a chair, wrecking all of them until Buddy finally blindsided him. Briscoe fought him to the stage where he found the button for the fire pyro. He set it off to test it, then put Buddy's head on it to light him on fire. Obviously, officials stopped him. Then he set the pyro off 3 times after they had already left. There was a woman sitting in the front row, and she had her head in her hand, like on the barricade, almost like laughing at what she was watching. And that's exactly how I felt. It was inventive and unique. I appreciated that, but it was patently ridiculous the way it transpired. On Dynamite, House of Black threatened Briscoe and mentioned fire. Then Briscoe backstage said he'd fight them in an Atlanta street fight. Jay Lethal came up, deciding to get his back. Briscoe said he didn't want Jeff Jarrett with them, but Lethal said, Jarrett's the type of low-down, grimy bastard they need. I went from really intrigued about this to not caring at all, now that the winners are blatantly obvious and that Briscoe's partners are Jeff Jarrett and Jay Lethal. They already had their feud in storyline. They already decided it wasn't going to work, but he's right back with them. Also, they had me hoping for like a unique stipulation involving fire, except it's just going to be a random street fight. I'm sure there's going to be fire elements to it. At least there should be. But they took any interest I had and just zapped it out all in the same segment on Dynamite. On Rampage, Claudio Castagnoli beat something called Ruggiero in 12 minutes. This was how the show opened. Never seen or heard of this guy before. Then Claudio low-blowed him for no reason with the dude's partner running out to make the save. On Collision, Bang Bang Scissor Gang beat the Dark Order in 7 minutes. This was the Acclaimed and Austin Gunn combination, except the ring announcer said Colton Gunn. They tried to turn Max Caster's rap fail into a gimmick, with Jay causing him to mess up his line here. On Collision, Christian Cage, Killswitch, Roderick Strong, and Brian Cage beat Orange, Trent, Daniel Garcia, and Hook in the main event of the show. Yes, for real. This was a random 8-man main event involving some people from Revolution as the end of a go-home show. Super weak. On Dynamite, Killswitch ran through Daddy Magic in a quick match. That kind of stemmed from what I just mentioned on Collision. Daniel Garcia saved him from further attacks, only to get laid out by Killswitch and Nick Wayne, who hit Wayne's World to end it. Christian Cage got up from commentary, and commentary said, oh, clearly he's going to the ring. Except they all just walked up the ramp. The entrance music wasn't even played until way, way too late, which gave us a key something was going to happen. Adam Copeland appeared at the top of the stage, hit Killswitch with a chair, choked out Wayne, stopped Shayna from a low blow, and then chased Christian through the crowd all the way backstage. Copeland demanded the feud ended where it started, 2 weeks from now in Toronto, an I Quit match, and it was literally made official 5 seconds later. And I love that I've been saying this for weeks, and some of you are finally coming around and tweeting me every single time it happens. It truly is ridiculous. So Copeland wasn't cleared for Revolution, but he's good to go 72 hours later. Now, I presume his clearance must have been questionable rather than denied straight out, so AEW made the safe play, or they just kayfabed the entire thing because they wanted to put the match in Toronto. And that's fine if they did that. Better to do it in Toronto for the crowd reaction to draw a rating than just putting it on Collision. The segment was mostly shit with multiple production issues, but the Copeland chase of Cage and Cage randomly stealing a guy's car and driving it away, that was fun at the end of it. On Rampage, Saraya and Harley Cameron backstage distracted Ruby Soho and Angela Parker just long enough so her brother Zach could take out Cool Hand's knee with a blackjack. Then he hit him in the back of the head with it, and Saraya told Ruby that she's the one who needed her. Captivating stuff. On Rampage, Rio beat Trish Adora in 7 minutes. This was her return to TV on Rampage against a nobody. Don't forget, Rio is super over with fans, and they only did this match because eventually we found out she was going to fight Stat on Dynamite. Also, Trish Adora is going to have another match this week. So now Trish Adora is in the Queen Aminata role. And by the way, we haven't seen Queen Aminata since she won that match. On Collision, Thunder Rosa beat a jobber in 2 minutes. She again cut a promo into the camera and held up a fist teasing LFI, I presume. And on Rampage, Lance Archer and The Righteous beat 3 jobbers in under 3 minutes. Why that match even happened, I, of course, cannot tell you. So that wraps up AEW this week. There was a lot of good, but again, it's almost entirely on Dynamite. And that has been the case for multiple weeks now. So you either have to make these other shows watchable or just make them completely irrelevant to your storylines. Because at this point, watching 3 extra hours of content every week to not have it matter that much into your major storylines, especially those that you're building for a pay-per-view, that is immensely frustrating for me just simply as a viewer who wants to like the product even more than I already do. So that wraps up AEW. Let's go ahead, move over to NXT. And this, of course, was the NXT Roadblock special show. As mentioned earlier, Lexus King narrated the open while driving a sports car. His beard was like next level Dominican lined up. Like, it was crazy sharp. Again, I could never get there even if I wanted to, even if I tried. I don't think I could find a barber probably who could do it. Luca Crisafino met with D'Angelo family. Tony D'Angelo explained that he needs a consigliere so they can become the most dominant force in NXT. It was a yes or no proposition, and Crisafino immediately accepted. Now, I have watched far too many mafia movies and shows to know that a consigliere is a high-powered and long-earned position. You do not welcome someone brand new into your family from the outside and make them your consigliere, your right hand. It just does not happen that way. Now, considering this is NXT and it's not the main roster, I'll let it slide a little bit, but it kind of deserves criticism. There had to be another term that they could have used for Crisafino. And then, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months from now, you make him the consigliere. It would have tracked better with reality. And that's not a nitpick. That's just the truth. Carmelo Hayes backstage was flanked by 4 much larger and more intimidating security guards. They were all wearing flak jackets and masks. Melo said these guys were handpicked to operate by any means necessary, ensuring he gets what's his. He said Tony D will wind up just like the last guy who tried to jump him in line, referring to Trick Williams. Melo also had a really cool Black Panther style necklace. Real diamonds or not, it was awesome. Playing off of last week's miscue with the security, that was really smart. And seeing that Hayes did not have his confidence shaken was key for his character. Ilya Dragunov backstage said he likes seeing Melo squirm to earn an opportunity. Stax and Crisafino came up saying D'Angelo would see Dragunov one way or another at Stand and Deliver. Getting Ilya's thoughts was appropriate because he's the one who decided on the match, but it was a big nothing of his segment. So we got D'Angelo against Hayes in the main event of the show. D'Angelo entered with a more serious, melodic, and also generic theme. It put out the right vibes, but I don't know, it didn't really work for me. He was still wearing the same gear, but it was more toned down with a khaki color instead of the bright red or blue or yellow. I was hoping for something more like slacks. We discussed that last week. Melo hit a lift up cutter. As Melo lined up for his finisher, Trick Williams' music hit to a huge pop, but Trick did not show up. D'Angelo caught Hayes distracted with a push spinebuster, and then he hit forget about it for the win. The match was pretty good, as is the case with most Tony D matches, but it just wasn't great. In terms of matches that went longer than 5 minutes on the show, it was actually the worst one. If I had to grade it, it'd be around like 3.25 stars, you know, a B, something like that. D'Angelo grabbed the mic and apologized for pulling the stunt with the entrance music, but he said he had a present for Melo. So Trick's music hit a second time and Williams popped out of the crowd. He got 2 shots on Melo. He individually beat up each of the security guards. Then he threatened Melo at the end, who dipped out of the ring and got held back by his security. Now, I alluded to this last week. I'm just not a fan of how this entire thing has gone down. D'Angelo losing the tag team titles and suddenly winding up in an NXT title match with zero legitimacy as a singles performer to put him at that level for a match on WrestleMania weekend, mind you, against an extremely strong champion in Ilya Dragunov. That is just poor booking. Maybe the worst from Shawn Michaels over the last 2 years. If Tony had enhanced his resume with multiple big singles wins over the 6 prior weeks, or if he had won a tournament, okay, I could stomach it. But this is an out-of-left-field challenger for the top title on the biggest show of the year, and he only got his number one contendership through one match via distraction, and it wasn't even that good of a match. And it's also not like he's massively over where one could make an exception. Wow, he is so freaking over, it makes sense they did it. He's the LA Knight of NXT, so they had to put him in this spot. The crowd's going to go crazy. I don't think it's going to. I cannot imagine this feud with Dragunov having any significant heat or interest unless they just get massively creative between now and Stand and Deliver, and I don't see that. And then you have the Trick return in the Mellow match, which obviously makes complete sense. But the path they took to get it, Hayes basically getting a title match, then having it taken away for no reason, it's ridiculous. It's almost like a triple threat was planned, but they decided to do two single matches instead, and they had to pivot. I did like that Mello was so worried about Trick that he didn't even have to return for him to lose the match via distraction. That's good storytelling. But Trick was so immensely hyped running back out into the ring. The whole sequence with the security was really sloppy. Mello took a bump without being hit. Trick missed contact on a dude. One of the security guards flung himself over the ropes. It was not as bad as that moment in AEW recently. It was probably 25% of that, though, and that's bad enough because that other thing was one of the worst things I've ever seen. Now, the crowd is all in with Trick. That's great. Trick and Mello at Stand and Deliver, that's going to be phenomenal. I don't doubt that one bit. And it's certainly going to main event, I would think at least, as a non-title match. They have some storytelling to do in order to have Hayes regain some momentum and confidence after he's looked kind of pathetic for multiple weeks consecutively. But again, I just don't understand why Tony D was pushed into the role when HBK easily could have brought in a main roster superstar to fight Dragunov and make just a better match, put more eyes on NXT, sell tickets to the show. Just looking at WWE's roster right now, you're telling me every single one of these guys will be on the WrestleMania card and is unavailable. Andrade, Chad Gable, Ricochet, Austin Theory, Montez Ford, hell, Karrion Kross. That's just a selection off the top of my head. What about running back Dijak, given we know what kind of bangers they can put on together? Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe there was just not a better option. But I simply do not get the decision-making whatsoever in Ilya, Tony D, on this particular show, booked in this particular way. Now, NXT this week, and you guys know we don't really talk about ratings on this show. It did its highest viewership since January 16th, so that was a positive because it was a special show. But it was still over 100,000 viewers down from where it started the first week of 2024. It was also the second straight week with a 0.16 demo, which ties its lowest since August 29th. This is what I'm talking about regarding a lack of understanding from me why WWE is not keeping its foot on the pedal with the brand. I get that they locked up the CW deal, and I'm not suggesting they have to have Becky Lynch and Seth Rollins down there. But there are certainly some main roster talents besides LWO that could be on that brand regularly, particularly involved in an extended feud going into the biggest show of the year. That's why I'm so adamant that someone else should have been challenging Dragunov in this spot. They could have brought Sheamus. What's Sheamus doing? If he's healthy, and maybe he's not healthy. So, I'll correct myself, of course, if he's uncleared and he's not able to go. But let's make believe he's cleared. Why would you not just do a Dragunov Sheamus program? That would be absolutely incredible. You come up with a way to excuse the Sheamus loss and you move on from there. Instead, it's Ilya and Tony D. And this whole thing is making it sound like I hate D'Angelo. I don't. I think he's really good. He's one of those four original NXT guys that they introduced when 2.0 started. I don't want to call him a pillar because that's the AEW term for their dudes, but he's one of those four dudes. And this is now his time in the spotlight, which is fantastic. But the way they've come to it and circled around to it, it's weak. It doesn't really make sense. And it's lackluster again for the biggest show of the year. I know I've repeated myself a few times, so I'll move on, but that's how strongly I feel about it. We had a WWE Women's Tag Team Championship match, the Kabuki Warriors defending against Lyra Valkyria and Tatum Paxley. Backstage before the match, Tatum was excited, saying they have to win the titles and she will do anything so they are permanently intertwined together. Lyra indicated they aren't exactly best friends, but just close at work. This was the mid-show main event. The Warriors were on one here, clearly head and shoulders better than the challengers. No surprise, of course. There was a fun moment where Kairi Sane bent over and started slapping her butt, which captivated Tatum. So Tatum then crawls over to her. They touch their foreheads together. Then Kairi pulls her hair and Tatum smiles because of it. And yes, it was exactly like it sounds. We tweeted it at Getting Overcast if you missed it, as Booker T would say, "Oh yeah, man," as the Silver King would say.
"Gonna look good, but she's got me saying, hey now."
Lyra and Tatum also hit stereo fisherman moves. The Warriors hit a codebreaker and a blockbuster sequence. Tatum and Lyra combined for a flying leg drop backbreaker, but Valkyria accidentally hit Paxley with a roundhouse kick. Kairi Sane then murdered Lyra with a spinning back fist and then hit the assisted insane elbow finisher to retain the titles. Kairi has really found her groove since returning. Like, it took her a little bit, but she's figured it out after a rough start. But she might have gotten rocked a bit here during the match. There was a moment where she seemed a bit off. Asuka was so, so good in this match. Because their skill level was so much higher, the match was a bit disjointed at times, but it was awesome seeing the Warriors back in NXT, and the match was fun overall. Again, like a 3.25, 3.5 most likely is what I would say. A B. I didn't specifically grade all of these matches, but it was definitely at that level. And what was cool was that this reminded me of being able to see Asuka a couple months ago live at that special NXT show I went to in Orlando, and it also reminded me that I randomly got to see Kairi team up with Io Shirai, that was her name then, for an NXT house show loop down in South Florida a few years ago. And that was back when Kairi was still on the main roster before she left WWE and went back to Japan. So it was just cool seeing them in NXT. Roxanne Perez, after this was over, threw Tatum outside and attacked Lyra viciously. She threw her through the turnbuckles into two ring posts and then bent her arm backwards over the turnbuckle bar, jumping off the rope onto the arm and snapping her elbow. Lyra was stretchered into an ambulance with Shawn Michaels and Ava both following her because they were so concerned. Forget like moody tweener. This is a full heel turn now for Perez. It was as shocking as it was impactful. She's been on top of her character work over the last couple of months. This has been the obvious stand and deliver match for a while. And while Lyra has done well as a champion, a title change would absolutely make sense. I'm not sure I've ever seen a wrestler use that like part of the turnbuckle in that manner. So super inventive there. I'm sure it's been done. I can't remember seeing it. Having HBK and Ava out there after commercial was a really nice touch to sell the seriousness of it all. And I found myself wondering here, maybe Lyra was really supposed to lose the title to Shotzi, because Roxanne Perez and Shotzi in the same kind of match really would make a lot of sense. So I'd be curious to find out if Shotzi did not get hurt, would she have won the title on NXT that night? Fallon Henley in the kitchen thanked Riley Osborne for giving Thea Hale clarity about what happened on their date. Osborne said he liked her as the firework that she used to be, but she's changed. Henley told him that she got bad advice to play hard to get. Blair Davenport popped in telling her to stay out of other people's business. Fallon kind of challenged her, but Blair scoffed and walked away. Yet they wound up having a match later in the show. So it was Henley and Davenport. Fallon dodged Blair, who need the steel steps. Suddenly, Sol Ruka appeared on the barricade and did a cartwheel DDT on Davenport. Henley immediately took advantage with a Shining Wizard to get the win. There was a surprising lack of pop from the fans, given A, Ruka's return. She was super over when she left. And B, the move she hit on Davenport looked awesome. She didn't get all of it, but a cartwheel DDT off a barricade? It sounds incredible. And the fans just like cheered normally. They didn't pop heavy like they did for the rest of the night. I know Sol is not a huge star, but again, the NXT crowd generally reacts well to stuff like this and was very hot for her before she got hurt. It was a short match, didn't really hit like it could. Tag team championships were on the line. Wolf Dogs defending against Chase U. The faction, at least for now, is rolling with six members. I think it makes it the largest faction in WWE. Braun Breaker speed ran the ropes with the champions hitting a 3D style gutbuster. Braun then hit a Frankensteiner and a flip over cutter, which needs a name because he's using it every match now. Duke Hudson went on a run and hit a German suplex after flinging himself over the ropes. Andre Chase hit that over the back flatliner. I think that used to have a name, but they didn't call it in the match. And Breaker sat Hudson on the announce table, hitting a full clothesline off the ring apron over the table. Really cool. Chase avoided Braun full speed into the steel steps, but Corbin hit the deep six with Breaker blind tagging for a spear to retain the titles. I think it was about 11, 12 minutes or so. Excellent from bell to bell. The Chase U run of offense was met with relative apathy, but there were numerous major spots and the final sequence was outstanding. This was another borderline B plus match, 3.5 stars B. After the bell, Thea lost her cool because as the guys were pouting on the ring steps, JC Jane held up an L for loser, basically shit talking them behind their backs. So Hale stormed to the back with the guys wondering why. Later, during the women's tag team title match, Thea was being pulled away from Kiana James and Izzy Dame as they were screaming at each other backstage. Then JC was shown tearing down the guys when Thea came in all manic, saying she got into it with these women. She had a tag team match set up for next week. JC acted aloof, saying she was busy, couldn't partner with her, as Hale expected that she would. I know she's only 19, but Thea went to high school. She knows when girls are being bitchy and catty. How she has not already decided that JC's a piece of shit and not her friend after the last few weeks, it's kind of silly. Hopefully that realization comes before she gets straight attacked, because it's not like Jane is hiding her disdain for her or anything like that. Joe Gacy fought Dijak in an asylum match. Reminder that this is a cage match with weapons already in it. One of them was a wood box that said do not open, and it revealed a spring-loaded boxing glove that hit Dijak right in the junk when he opened it. Dijak hit a perfect moonsault from the top of the cage, flat on the canvas, crotch to face. Then he put Gacy in a straitjacket, but got pushed off the ropes himself through a smiley face table. Gacy then hit almost like a corkscrew swanton bomb. Dijak blinded Gacy with duct tape and hit him with a kendo stick, but ate a mule kick and a uranagi. Gacy started beating him with a kendo stick, only for Dijak to choke throw him through a door. Dijak hit feast your eyes. Gacy actually no-sold it, stood up. Dijak hit a second feast your eyes for the 1-2-3 in about 13 minutes. Some of the ridiculousness of Gacy getting offense with his arms tied or while blinded was totally fine. No selling the first finisher after all that punishment I thought was stupid. Luckily, it only lasted 5 seconds because Dijak just hit another one and ended it. It was an excellent match bell to bell. Dijak was the right winner, as we suggested last week. He needs the elevation after losing a number of recent feuds. I'm at 3.75 stars, B+ here. I thought it was the match of the night. It was on the verge of an A-, but it fell short at the end. It was still a blast as the opener for the show. Josh Briggs approached Brooks Jensen backstage, asking if he's sure about fighting Obafemi next week, given how dominant he has been running through NXT. Jensen passionately shot back that Briggs told him to grow balls, and that's exactly what he did. After Jensen walked away, Dijak passed Briggs, saying he lied to Jensen's face because he knows Jensen is a dead man walking. Oh, I'm sure as hell here for Dijak versus Briggs. Hoss versus Hoss.
There's a lot of beef out here.
I mean, they better reinforce the ring post for a match like this.
Reinforce the ring post. The beef's going to be flying tonight, gentlemen.
It remains silly that Jensen gets a title match because he asked for one after Briggs literally beat him head to head and did not get a title match. But it seems like something larger is building here from a storyline standpoint. So again, we'll put a pin in it and we'll see what happens next week. No Quarter Catch Crew hit the ring with Drew Gulak putting over Charlie Dempsey as the new Heritage Cup champion. Dempsey said the cup fits with his vision for the sport. Then Damon Kemp explained the cup belongs to the faction and they will take turns defending it. They also announced that they will enter a team in a previously unannounced NXT Tag Team Elimination Tournament for a new number one contendership for the titles at Stand and Deliver. Suddenly, out of nowhere, William Regal made his return to TV with loud Regal chants, and then That's Your Father chants, of course, directed to Dempsey. Regal put over the cup as a tribute to the greatest European wrestlers in history. He hoped that No Quarter Catch Crew would defend it with the honor and integrity it deserves. Dempsey stepped to his father saying he would defend it better than he ever could. Regal said he'll be watching, and he stared them down. This was very much just like a proud papa moment. Neither of them could hold back their grins being in the ring together. I'm not a huge fan of the cup being defended with the foursome. I would rather just be Dempsey, especially after this segment. And I'm not a fan of the tournament being announced offhand during a promo like this. But that Regal moment was outstanding. It was great to see him back on TV in his first segment ever with his son. They've never interacted before, not in NXT UK, not in NXT, not anywhere. Noam Dar was catatonic backstage in the Metaphor Lounge. They were trying to figure out how to revive him, with Lash Legend basically saying she couldn't go through this again. But all she did was kind of redirect his attention. He snapped out of it, and they all celebrated together. It was silly, but that's their gimmick, so it's fine. At least they aren't repeating the same storyline with him, like needing to get the cup back. Shawn Spears ran through Uriah Connors. Spears had a full chairman-style entrance with a spotlight like an AEW. He got welcome back chance before quickly hitting the C4 for the win. It was a methodical and deliberate effort. Spears was kind of playing mind games. Connors, by the way, is Brogan Finley, the son of Fit Finley. So this was his first WWE TV match. He cut a promo under a spotlight Spears did after the bell, calling Ridge Holland a hypocrite. Then he stood still as Holland charged the ring, letting him attack. As Holland was attacking, Spears slid him the chair and opened his arms, basically telling Holland, embrace it, kill me, whatever you want to do. Four referees ran in to stop him, and Ridge ultimately tossed the chair aside, screaming that Spears doesn't know him. In the NXT parking lot, Spears said he was expecting a challenge from Holland. He claimed that Rage would be Holland's best friend, and it was time for him to embrace it. As we said last week, not really a needle mover by any means. Spears is a value add to NXT just from an experience standpoint. I'd like to see him get the contacts back, just give him some more presence and just character in his look. The stuff with Holland played into what Spears was saying about him, but just an NI situation. No interest, at least for now. Maybe next week changes that. I don't really see it. Ava backstage informed Gigi Dolin that Ariana Grace won't fight her no matter how many times she asks. Grace said that she doesn't see the point in fighting, with Dolin reminding it's literally their job. Ariana ultimately decided to accept on the condition that if she beats her, Gigi lets Ariana bring out her inner beauty and allows her to become a true lady. Ava is literally the general manager. She can make whatever match she wants. So that was a really stupid premise. Ultimately, though, it's a fun segment and idea. Gigi, like, going to finishing school or something with Ariana teaching her, that could be really funny in the coming weeks. Mr. Stone was fuming watching Alexis King promo after NXT. Von Wagner came in saying he would smash King, but Stone said that Alexis made it personal and he wanted to fight him one-on-one to stand up for himself and his family. Von argued, but ultimately relented. And you know my thoughts on this. It's a big batch of whatever. Hopefully Alexis King wins, and hopefully Stone and Wagner move on to something else that really doesn't matter at the bottom of the card. So folks, that wraps up NXT Roadblock this week. You know, as mentioned, a lot of highs. There were really good matches on the show. But when they do these TV specials so frequently, there's multiple title matches, no title changes. And if the main storyline is not going to completely hit, then it almost feels a little bit worthless to a degree. And again, the Trick and Mello stuff hit. The execution wasn't 100% there. And when we go back and talk about what the NXT title match is going to be for Stand and Deliver, Ilya against Tony D, the Silver King just is not that interested in it. There's plenty of time. Maybe they completely turn me around by the time we get to that show. But at this point, I just don't think I'm that into it. I think Trick and Mello is going to be great. Roxy and Lyra is going to be great. Most likely the Wolf Dogs against the Good Brothers. That'll make a lot of sense. Probably change the titles. But, you know, I got to see the way the rest of this show is built out. Maybe it's Thea Hell, JC Jane gets on the card. Obafemi probably should have a multi-man match for the North American Championship. Ideally, they go and do the ladder match and try to bring that back from, like, what was it, NXT TakeOver New Orleans. That was incredible. Hopefully they do something like that. That could be a huge match on the show. But of course, we still got plenty of time, and we will discuss the building of NXT Stand and Deliver over the next few weeks. So folks, that wraps up this edition of the Getting Over Wrestling Podcast. On the way out, allow me to remind you that this show
is all about Defy.
So head on over to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a 5-star rating on Apple. Take a little extra time. Leave a 5-star written review. If you do, we will read it live right here on the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Getting Overcast for episode drops, news, analysis, highlights, all of that good stuff. You can also tweet and DM us questions and comments, and we will do our best to include them on the show. Please also remember,
I happen to love the number 5.
And I hope you do as well, because for $5 a month or $50 for the entire year, you can become an official Getting Overhead. Just visit buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Sign up, you get bonus audio, the fastest 5 minutes in professional wrestling, instant reactions to Raw, NXT, Dynamite, and SmackDown every week, along with exclusive news posts every Friday. Again, you can get all of it. 5 a month, $50 for the year. buymeacoffee.com/gettingover. Thank you all for listening to this edition of the show. We will be back on Tuesday with our next WWE episode. And 1 week from now, same bat time, same bat channel, we'll be talking NXT and AEW. But at this point, it is time for the Silver King to sign off and leave you with just 3 final words. Bye for now.